Today we're looking at, like I just said, Leviticus 17 and 18. These chapters begin what is known as the Holiness Code, which is the rest of the book, honestly. So far what we've looked at, by and large, covers rituals, ceremonies, sacrifices, the opening days of the whole ritual system. And this section, you see a repeated rhythm of be holy as I am holy, be holy as I am holy. And I've talked a few times already about how holiness, especially as we've seen it so far, really doesn't necessarily equate to what we normally think of it as. Holiness being moral perfection is how we normally think of it. So normally when we hear be holy as I am holy, we hear be perfect as I am perfect. But that kind of breaks down when all of a sudden the altar is considered holy and the tabernacle is considered holy. So we've talked about how that concept is broader than just the moral aspect of holiness. But in these chapters, we will clearly see that morality is certainly a part of holiness. So when we talk about holiness, and I say that it is broader than morality, by that, never hear me to say that it does not include an aspect of morality. It is certainly part of it, and we will see that in most of these chapters as we continue to work through the book. So these chapters, again, 17 through 27, all are part of the Holiness Code. In this section, one of the other major concepts that we will see that we've hinted at and talked about a little bit so far already is that there is no sacrifice for clear, defiant, intentional offenses. We've gotten past the part of the book that is about the sacrifices. They will be alluded to at times in the rest of the book, but by and large, what you're going to see with all these offenses is pretty much you pay it back, or you possibly get kicked out of the community, or you die. Those are kind of the three major categories of consequences that we will see for a lot of these actions in the rest of the book. There are all sorts of like levels of even within those, and there are some things where it doesn't seem like really any of those apply. So I think it's actually next week we'll actually take some time and dig into all like kind of the tiers of punishment that are present in these chapters. But just realize that, again, equating holiness to morality, we normally conflate the two, and then because of that, how we view the sacrificial system, we view it like how it works now through Christ, and the two just aren't the same. There's so many differences, as we've talked about all these weeks, that really the new covenant, as Hebrews says again and again and again, is so much better than the old covenant. Not that in the new covenant you can just like excuse whatever you want to do, but that the work that Christ did is broader and more cleansing than what was offered in the old covenant. And we'll dig into kind of the ramifications of that as we go. But we will see that concept really driven home here in these chapters as we talk about certain sins or even just ritual things that there really is no sacrifice for. The laws of the Holiness Code open and close with a warning against idolatry in chapter 17 and chapters 26, 1 to 2. Chapters 18 and 20 discuss laws about sexual immorality. 19 discusses various community laws. 21 and 22 discuss priestly criteria and restrictions and define acceptable offerings. 23 and 24 discuss the sacred calendar, sanctuary procedures, and then blasphemy. And then 25 discusses economic laws. 26 is, then the book's kind of weird. 26 is effectively the conclusion, because it ends with the blessings and the cursings, blessings for obedience, cursings for disobedience. And then 27 is honestly functionally kind of a postscript that breaks down the funding of the tabernacle. And you can tell that it's kind of a postscript because 26 ends with like an actual conclusion. Like these are the laws, like this is done. And then you actually have that same thing at 27. So 27, it's been theorized, is kind of like was added on at the end to make sure that like it was clear and made permanent how the tabernacle was funded. So when we get there, I'm actually going to talk about 26 and 27 in reverse on that Sunday, because we're going to deal with all like the closing funding laws and stuff like that for the tabernacle, and then I will talk about the actual conclusion of the book, which is the blessings and the cursings. So just kind of a logistical note there for going forward. But getting back to our chapters for today, chapters 17 and 18. Chapter 17 opens the Holiness Code with laws against pagan worship and practice. It makes sense. We start the Holiness Code, which is, again, broadly speaking, basically the rules for how you act now that you are in covenant with God. And by the way, these chapters, by and large, are actually addressed to the entire community. Up until now, the focus has primarily been the Levites and the priesthood and how they are to officiate and to perform these ceremonies and rituals. The people have obviously been included because they're going to be the ones bringing these sacrifices and stuff, but primarily the audience has been the priesthood. Now, primarily the audience is going to be the entire community. We do see a couple chapters where he actually kind of gets specific towards the priesthood again, and obviously the priesthood are included in understanding all of this stuff because they're the ones that help to kind of monitor and guard and watch for purity. But these chapters, by and large, are addressed to the entire community because they discuss what it looks like to be a community that is in covenant with God. So it makes sense then that this first chapter discusses first that you worship God. Like, if you're a community that's in covenant with God, God should probably be the only God that you worship. So that, again, is the logical place to start here in chapter 17. So that's the basic understanding. But then as far as it gets into some specifics that kind of are a little confusing for us, especially if we don't have the background, luckily these really build on a lot of things that we've already talked about up to this point. So looking at the first four verses of chapter 17, these first four verses say, "And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to Aaron and his sons and to all the people of Israel, and say to them, This is the thing that the Lord has commanded. If any of the house of Israel kills an ox or a lamb or a goat in the camp and kills it outside the camp, and does not bring it to the entrance of the tent of meeting to offer it as a gift to the Lord in front of the tabernacle of the Lord, blood guilt will be imputed to that man. He has shed blood, and that man shall be cut off among his people." If you just stop right there, these verses seem like nonsensical. Like, they just seem like a logistic nightmare. If you kill or slaughter an animal anywhere, inside the camp or outside the camp, you have to bring it to the tabernacle. And my mind immediately is just thinking the logistics. Like, there are, I mean, depending on which census you go by throughout the Pentateuch, there are a lot of people. And the priests currently are just Aaron and his sons. So if every single person who ever killed any animal had to bring it to the priests, there would be the longest waiting line ever. So that's where my mind immediately goes. Luckily, the rest of the context clarifies that that's not quite what's going on. Depending on your translation, in verse 3, it says, "If anyone in the house of Israel kills." The word kills there has a semantic range that can either be just generally speaking kill, but the more accurate one contextually is kill for the purpose of a sacrifice or offering. So it's much more limiting than the logistical nightmare that one might imagine, especially when you consider, when you look at the punishment for it, like, you're cut off from your people. So, like, to me, again, in my mind, I'm like, okay, so if you don't stand in this days-long line, you get cut off from your people. It's like, no, that's not what's going on. What's going on is if anybody of the people of Israel kill an animal with the purpose of offering it as a sacrifice or an offering and do not make that offering or sacrifice to God, they are cut off from the people. In the context of 1 through 9, makes this pretty clear as you go along. Because again, if you stop at 4, it's like, whoa, really confusing. But like, just read 5 through 9, and it really lays it out clearly. Our first clue, honestly, though, is even in these first few verses, where it specifies which animals this is. If anyone of house Israel kills an ox, a lamb, or a goat, the three most common animals offered in offerings and sacrifices. Notice that it doesn't talk about other animals, which kind of tips you off right away that this is thinking about offerings and sacrifices. And then verse 5 clearly states that the reason for the wording of 1 through 4 is so that the people bring their offerings to the Lord. So if you go to 5, it says, "This is to the end, that the people of Israel may bring their sacrifices that they sacrifice in the open field, that they may bring them to the Lord, to the priest at the entrance of the tent of meeting, and sacrifice them as sacrifices of peace offering to the Lord." So, I mean, 5 right there basically just answers the logistical dilemma. And then verse 7 specifically condemns sacrifices to goat demons, but if you read 1 through 9, this context makes it obvious that any sacrifice to any god or being or thing other than God is not to be done by a person in Israel. And the punishment is being cut off from the people, because essentially what you're doing at that point by offering a sacrifice to any other deity is you're essentially saying, I am not loyal to God. Well, the definition of being God's people is to be loyal to God. So therefore, if you're saying, I am showing disloyalty to God and loyalty to another being, God is essentially saying the punishment is what you were asking for. You're saying, I am not loyal to God and loyal to somebody else. Like, all right, well, then you're cut off from people because you can go be loyal to the God that you're being loyal to. You're not part of my people anymore at that point. So the being cut off from the people is actually a very, honestly, natural consequence for that disobedience. And then 10 through 16 kind of seem to take a turn in a new direction, where it's all of a sudden talking about blood. And this is something we've discussed many times. But this 10 through 16, the remainder of chapter 17, is actually an expansion on verse 6. And if you go to verse 6, it says, "And the priest shall throw the blood on the altar of the Lord at the entrance of the tent of meeting, and burn the fat for a pleasing aroma to the Lord." This isn't like a throwaway, like, we're just going to say this because this is what normally happens. Like, the flow of the context here would have actually made sense without verse 6. You don't need it. But it is put in there on purpose, because these aren't just, like, frivolous details. It's specifically a reminder to the people of what the purpose of blood is and who the fatty portions in the blood belong to. Which, these are a big deal, because in that culture, these are two things that honestly are the two main things that are going to be misused by the people and used in worship of another deity or for self-seeking purposes. The blood is not to be used in any ways common to the pagan practices around them. And the fatty portions, again, belong to the Lord. And the reasoning here is that blood, or life, in the ancient mindset, like, blood was life force. Like, it was essentially the essence of life that flowed out of you if it was pouring out. And then the fatty portions, which represent the food, these two things, the blood and the fatty portions, are gifts from God that are to be used properly and given back to God, who is the source of life and of all good things. And then the next two sections, we'll dig more into the 10 and 16, but just flashing forward briefly, the next two sections appropriately then discuss first a proper understanding of blood in 10 to 16, and then, and the rules to follow in light of that, and then also laws against sexual immorality, which is also a misusing of the gift of intimacy for which God has given one appropriate context. So there is actually a logical flow here of why you have idolatry and then immorality and adultery back to back to each other. Because both of them are inherently a misuse of a good gift from God. The first one is the blood and the fatty portions, which again represent life. God is the source of life. Fatty portions are food and sustenance, and God is the source of all things. And those two things, how you view them, how you use them, is supposed to represent your understanding and your acknowledgement that this is a gift from God that I'm giving back to him, that I'm thanking him for. And then sexual immorality is another realm where you have a good gift from God that is being misused. So there's again a logical connection there, and there are a bunch more connections that we'll get into elsewhere as well. And honestly, another reason why these two are lumped together is you see idolatry and adultery hooked in the Bible a ton of times. And they're oftentimes honestly used as a metaphor for each other. The prophets constantly are talking against Israel in adultery terms in regard to their idolatry. And you even see that in these verses. In verse 7, it says that the people are said to whore after the goat demons, which is, again, sexual immorality language that's right there in the idolatry section. So there's a hook there that brings us right into the next chapter. But first, before we keep getting into the connections there, let's get back to the view of blood and the rules against the blood. In verse 10, we read that drinking blood is such a blatant offense that God himself will ensure that this person who does this will be cut off. And the reasons we are given for this are twofold. The life, we are told, of the flesh is in the blood. And this gets back all the way even to Genesis 9 understanding. And then also we are told that it has been given by God to the people to make atonement for their lives. There's a bit to break down there. But first, blood symbolizes life, which is a gift from God and of which he is the source. And again, this isn't the first time we've seen this in the Bible. And this isn't the first prohibition against blood that we've seen in Leviticus either. But again, blood symbolizing life, God is the source of life and life is a gift from him. He has authority over it. To misuse this gift, this gift of life symbolized by the blood, to misuse this gift for one's own purposes, as was common, again, in all the nations around them, this misuse was punishable by banishment, of God cutting off, which, again, the logic is very similar to the idolatry one where they're choosing to show loyalty to a god other than God. It's the same idea here. We'll talk a little bit about the practices and why that's so. But it was common in that day to use blood in an attempt to renew or reinforce one's vitality. Because again, you think about it, blood symbolizes life. Blood's kind of seen as a life force, a life fluid. So therefore, if I ingest some or drink some or whatever from another animal or another whatever it is, I'm kind of renewing and maybe even adding on to my own vitality and my own life. It is, in a sense, honestly, a way of playing God and saying, I am able to take authority and control over my own life. And God has made very clear in Scripture that He is the sole authority and author and source of life. So to try to use this blood, which symbolizes the life and the life force, for this purpose is essentially saying, I reject God's place as God, and I put myself as God and give myself authority over life. Which again, you see right there, back to the logic of the idolatry and why they're cut off from the people. It's because they're just being disloyal to God. Same exact thing. This is essentially an attempt to oust God from his seat of authority, if even just in this one aspect of like your own vitality and your own life. So that's why the punishment is being cut off, and that's why God himself says that he will cut them off. Because they are ousting him, attempting to oust him from his chair. He's like, well, if you attempt to do that, I'm going to be the one who makes sure that this punishment happens. Because you can't oust me from my chair. And then the symbolism of blood for life also explains why blood is the powerful disinfectant that we have seen it be so far. Because we've talked a lot about how blood is used in these ritual practices, of how it cleanses and disinfects the temple and purifies these things from ritual impurity. We haven't spent much time honestly talking about like how that actually works. Because I mean, if you think about it, does anybody here, when they're trying to clean the house, anybody go around splattering blood on things? Does that work very well? It's not a very good disinfectant. So how does this thing that honestly makes things more dirty make things more pure? How does that work? It works because of the symbolism and what the blood represents. It's not about things actually being disinfected. It's about things symbolically and spiritually becoming pure. We are finally told here that blood makes atonement by the life. And what this means is that the life of the animal that the blood represents makes atonement for the life of the person bringing the offering or sacrifice. Notice, however, that this blood substitution, this sacrifice, this cleansing, notice that it must be given and only happens specifically on the altar. That is where the priest sprinkles the blood. Pours it outside of the altar, he puts it on the horns, he sprinkles it in front of the tent or in front of the veil, like all different places depending on which ceremony is happening. We've talked about all that. But this specifically has to happen on the altar in order to make atonement. It does not make atonement on its own, apart from God's approved way. I have been careful not to dwell too much on this substitutionary aspect of the blood, because if we jump into it too soon, what we end up doing is we jump immediately to the New Testament and we shortcut past a full understanding of what's going on in the Old Testament. So this is why before I've kind of hinted at there is substitutionary happening. There's substitutionary happening that we saw in the riddance rituals and stuff like that. But even in just the act of any offering or sacrifice where an animal is killed and blood is used, there is substitution there. But I purposely kind of put it off until now to make sure that we also understand all the other things that are going on there in addition to the substitution. The death of the animal and the substitution of their blood for the blood of the person is a reminder that even ritual impurity, because again, as we've talked through these chapters, a lot of the stuff that's being that's resulting in offerings and sacrifices, it's ritual stuff. It's not moral stuff. But even a buildup of this ritual impurity can eventually result in God's wrath being poured out on the people. Now, this is especially clear when you get to the high priest having to do an offering or the a representation of the whole community and an offering happening there. That's where you have the extra purification of those riddance rituals happening, because essentially it's symbolism saying that, hey, like if we've gotten to the level of the high priest in the community, if y'all don't do something, like there's going to be consequences. And there's a reminder of that even in just the individual level. An individual, however little their ritual impurity may be, however just blanked on the word, however accidental or inconsequential their thing that they did seems, if this stuff is allowed to build up, it can result in the wrath of God. And there is a reminder of that, even on the individual lowest level offense you can think possible. The fact that an animal has to be killed and blood used as a disinfectant is a reminder that this stuff has consequences if left unchecked. So because the blood represents the gift of life from God and is also his chosen method of substitution, it is not ever to be used for one's own purpose. The people are not to try to manipulate this gift for their own desires, and they are not to seek to cleanse themselves with it, which, by the way, is again why it's specified this happens on the altar, at the tabernacle, through the priests who are doing things according to how God told them to do everything through the word of Moses. So this isn't something you can cleanse yourself with, which is, again, potentially another way that these people were misusing the blood and trying to drink the blood. Like, hey, maybe if I drink this, I can just purify myself for life. Like, I just keep drinking blood once in a while. I never have to go to the tabernacle. Because, like, no, that's not how this works. You don't clean yourself. I have given you one way to make atonement and to cleanse yourself. And that's the way that I have provided for you. Oh, that sounds like New Testament. There is so much foreshadowing here that is happening in every single aspect of this even ritual system. Then and now, we cannot cleanse ourselves in God's eyes. This is the work that he makes possible through his chosen means. Old covenant, new covenant. It's always been the same. So this misuse of a good gift from God for one's own purposes, in an attempt to satisfy one's own desires and to use it for one's own means, leads logically to our next chapter. Our next chapter discusses sexual immorality. In fact, there are many conceptual links between idolatry and immorality, even in just these two chapters. Both involve going elsewhere for something that God has given only one appropriate context. Again, in the offering, this blood substitution, this cleansing, this purification, whatever word you want to use, this only has effect on the altar. That is where it is designed to happen. And now, in this chapter, we have a long list of sexual immoralities that are forbidden because they are not happening. They are using a good gift from God in a context where it is not designed to happen. Both also involve using a gift from God for one's own selfish purposes. In the use of the blood, you can use it to try to play God over your own vitality. And in sexual immorality, by and large, a lot of context then and now of where we see sexual immorality is a person not usually thinking about the consequences of their action, not usually thinking about how it affects other people, but simply gratifying their own desires. Is inherently a selfish thing, by and large. Both take something that is pure and a source of life and turn it into impurity and a source of death, as we will see. Understanding the cultural background of these two chapters helps us to see that the motivations for idolatry and adultery are actually very similar, and so are their consequences. We tend to teach against sexual immorality from the Bible in a very one-dimensional way. The Bible says it's wrong, so it's wrong. We might add stuff about creation order or how it violates our body as the temple of the Holy Spirit or about the beauty of the biblical ideal. And by the way, honestly, I don't say this as like an offense to people. I know that there's many good teachings and classes and people are working within their own families to give a more nuanced understanding of that. But what I'm saying is, by and large, honestly, from the pulpit, we don't do a very good job of giving a very multifaceted, nuanced view. Because honestly, it's something we're not comfortable talking about. Like, who wants to just sit here and give all sorts of, like, reasons and arguments and really honestly just dwell on this topic as a thing for very long? But the Bible actually has a great deal to say about the negative consequences of sexual immorality, and it gives a very multifaceted argument against it. It is not just one-dimensional, like, just don't do it. It actually gives many reasons, and a lot of them aren't necessarily obvious unless you understand the cultural reasoning what's going on. And what one of the things we're going to see here, even in this chapter, is simply the way things are grouped gives us some cultural messaging about some reasons behind the prohibitions against certain types. And the reason for this broad, multifaceted argument that you see in the Bible is that both Old and New Testament, the Bible was written to contexts in which the surrounding cultures did not view many of the things that the Bible says as wrong as wrong. We used to live in a culture where most people agreed that things that the Bible said were wrong to do, especially in the area of sexual morality. We used to live in a culture where, that, by and large, people agreed with that. And because of that, as a church, until fairly recently, honestly, probably until the last, you know, two or three decades or so, we haven't had to give too much of a multifaceted argument. Like, we're able to just say it's wrong and most people agree with us. Well, yeah, that's a thing that's wrong. That's not really the case anymore. As I was talking with Matt, actually, just kind of brainstorming about this sermon, he brought up a really good point that honestly, even just the term sexual immorality means something totally different nowadays. If you think about how it functionally works out in the culture, something that is sexually immoral, honestly, what people hear that is, you're telling me not to do something that I want to do. It is sexually immoral to tell me that I can't do something I want to do, especially as long as the two parties are consenting. So it is immoral to limit sexual freedom. That's kind of where we're at as a culture. A lot of these prohibitions and rules that we have, and Leviticus here and all throughout the Bible, honestly, as long as both parties are consenting, a lot of these things aren't really necessarily viewed as wrong. This is not, however, what the phrase sexual immorality means in the Bible. As a culture, we can hear that and say, you're immoral to tell me not to do something that I want to do. That's actually pretty much the exact opposite of what the Bible means when it says something is sexually immoral. God, in his word, makes it very clear that there's only one appropriate context for sexual relations. This is the moral way of doing it. And the word immoral literally means not moral. So when you see sexually immoral in the Bible, what it means is basically anything outside of that one context. And you see that all throughout the Bible. Here you have a bunch of stuff. Later in Leviticus 20, you have basically the same, but a couple are a little different. And then in Deuteronomy, and again and again and again, we read a passage of 1 Corinthians that talks about stuff. And what the Bible is getting at is essentially anything that is outside of this one context that I've given you. I've given you this good gift to be used in this one way that I know is best for you. And to use it outside of that context is what all these prohibitions talk against. Our text today focuses largely on incest, or having intimate relations with somebody closely related to you other than your wife. But it also briefly covers a few other topics of immorality. Before the text begins listing forbidden unions, however, the chapter opens with an exhortation basically for the people to not be like the Egyptians or the Canaanites. If instead they keep God's rules, they will live by them. This admonition is given further explanation at the end of the chapter, where we see that their possession of the land is contingent on their obedience to these laws. What's kind of odd about this admonition is you'd honestly think that this would come back in 17. 17, if you read about idolatry, there actually is no, like, don't be like Egyptians, don't be the Canaanites, don't do this, honor me, and if you do this, you'll keep the land. Like, you'd think that would come with what gods they worship. But it actually is given here in the realm of sexual immorality. And that kind of strikes us as a little weird. It's like, okay, so is this one more important than the other one? There's a conceptual link here. So honestly, throughout the Bible, to say this against sexual immorality is honestly saying it against idolatry as well. But there is also a kind of background thing that's happening here that's really easy to miss, because it is drawing on an event in Genesis that is weird and that is worded in a way that we don't really understand what's happening. So why in 18, largely speaking about incest, is this long admonition given? And why is it, like, specifically incest that is the thing surrounded by this? The answer to both questions is found back in Genesis 9. So I'll have you keep your finger in Leviticus and turn back to Genesis 9. We'll be looking at Genesis 9, verses 18 to 29. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but you can go ahead and skim it while I'm talking. But to summarize, this passage is a really strange account of something that happens right after the flood. And in it, we read that Noah gets drunk and lays uncovered in his tent, and then his youngest son, Ham, sees his nakedness and tells his brothers. Then the other sons, Shem and Japheth, walk backwards and cover their father. And then, after Noah finds out what happens, he curses not Ham, but Ham's son, Canaan. And if you pay close attention to the details of this account, it should honestly leave you with a bunch of questions. What just happened? Why is the curse on Canaan, not Ham? And, like, this is just weird. Like, so what's going on? So the first question that should honestly come to mind is, if you know anything about, like, ancient contexts, like, even today, third world contexts, how on earth, in an ancient context in which there is not even remotely close to the level of personal privacy that we have nowadays, how on earth is seeing the nakedness of your father something that is punished so severely that your son is cursed to a perpetual generation of servanthood to his uncle's descendants? You're like, that seems weird, because I'm pretty sure that would be something, especially in that ancient context, that would happen a decent amount. So the punishment seems like ridiculously out of bounds. And then also, again, why is Ham's son cursed instead of Ham? Because Ham is the one that did this. And then also, if the punishment is going to be Ham's son, why is it his fourth son and not his first son? Because if you read forward in chapter 10, Canaan is not Ham's first son. So you'd think, if this is like, well, I'm going to curse your descendants, you'd think, especially culturally speaking, be the firstborn, because the firstborn is the one that gets the largest inheritance. So, okay, like, one, it's weird that Ham didn't get cursed. And two, it's really weird that it wasn't his oldest son that got cursed. And then also, why is the punishment that is given to Canaan specifically to be a servant to the descendant of his uncles? There is a lot to unpack here, but the wording of Leviticus 18 and later in 20 helps us to see through the idioms and the euphemisms being used here in Genesis 9, because that's what I'm going to argue is going on. There's a lot of euphemisms that are happening. If you even just skim, because the wording is used a lot, if you even just skim Leviticus 18 and 20, you'll see the uncover nakedness language a lot. To uncover or see somebody's nakedness is a euphemism for having sexual relations with them. Further, 18:7 clarifies that the nakedness of your father refers to the nakedness of your mother. So, in Genesis 9, what Ham did actually concerned his mother, and Canaan is cursed because he is the result of that wrongful union. Canaan is cursed to servanthood because what Ham did, culturally speaking, the motivation for what he did was basically to attempt to assert himself as the leader of the tribe and take over the whole family after the flood. He, as the youngest son, is trying to create himself and assert himself as the leader of the family dynasty after the flood. So now, back in our text today, now the descendants of Shem are being warned not to fall into the sin of Ham, who, by the way, they're warned not to be like the people of Egypt or Canaan. Guess who Egypt and Canaan came from? Ham. He fathered both Egypt and Canaan. So basically, the descendants of Shem are being warned not to follow in the example of Ham, which is essentially how the nations of Egypt and Canaan got to where they are. They started in immorality and bad decisions, and they've kind of just continued it since then. And the descendants of Shem are being told not to follow in their ways. And also, this connection back to Genesis 9, this hook back into Genesis 9, is even made even more obvious by the fact that the first specific prohibition given in Leviticus chapter 18, verse 7, is, "You shall not uncover the nakedness of your father, which is the nakedness of your mother. She is your mother. You shall not uncover her nakedness." There is a reason, I would argue, that is the first specific prohibition that's given, because the whole way that this chapter is structured and that this section of Leviticus is structured is pointing back to Genesis 9. And then verses 6 through 19 detail various other forms of incest. The specific words used in these scenarios, by the way, kind of the range behind them, because it's easy to read them and be like, well, like, what's going on? Is it marriage? Is it, like, rape? Is it just like consensual? Like, what is happening? The wording actually being used purposefully is using words that can include all of that in the range of meaning. And basically what the point is none of that. I don't care what your context is for it. You don't do any of it. Because the whole point of this section, like if the point of the section was literally just to say don't do what Ham did, it could stop at verse 7? Yeah, the first specific one there. It could stop there and not even go into other stuff. But the whole point is expanding out his sin to talk about all of the contexts in which that type of misuse and abuse of a gift from God can be used. This is because the point of these prohibitions is not just preventing a sin like Ham's, but it's also defining who is and is not allowed for one to be married to. These verses define who is considered to be one's immediate family and therefore prohibited from marriage. This is especially important since marriage within one's own tribe was encouraged. So the kind of prevailing thought is you try to maintain the unity and the strength of the tribe by marrying within your tribe, but God's saying, okay, like, yes, but be wise with how you do that. And this is kind of the breakdown of the family tree, and everybody this close to you, you don't touch. Like, you don't, I don't care what sort of context you're thinking that you're going to have with that person, that's not going to happen. So you need to be outside of that. So there's kind of like layers within the tribe. There's your immediate family, and then there's the extended family, and then there's like the people that aren't even really related to you beyond the fact they're in the same tribe. So like that's the goal of this is it's pushing you out farther from those layers. And the reason to do this is because to marry too close to one's own family blurs family lines and usually destroyed family relations and unity. Verses 6 through 19 can be summarized as rules that are pro-family. They prohibit any sort of immorality or union that would break down the family unity and structure. By and large, they seek to prevent rivalries and power grabs. Power grabs would be represented by something like Ham did, and are honestly the context for a lot of these. Like basically anything where somebody is having incest with somebody in the generation above them is a power grab. And then usually somebody having incest with someone in the same generation or the generation below causes rivalries. And you see that explicitly with some of the wording here. You have to realize, just an aside, that this is a polygamous culture, that at this time, there was no clear law against polygamy. There are a lot of cultural and societal things, reasons going on that we can talk about later. But anyways, so that was an allowance that God was making at the time. And even within that, though, he was giving clear rules to avoid breaking apart family units. And one of them, it was actually made really clear in the fact that like you don't take a rival sister. Like if one of your wives has a sister, you don't take her sister to be a rival wife. And honestly, that one, you can look back in Genesis and you're like, yeah, that would have been a good idea for a lot of these people. So like, again, a lot of these things kind of build on things that like the people already knew was a bad idea. And God's like, yeah, that is a bad idea. You shouldn't do that. So he's making rules against it. But anyway, so 6 through 19 can be summarized as pro-family. This is God seeking to maintain the unity of a family, to prevent rivalries, to prevent power grabs, to prevent people from destroying the family from within through their choices. And then 19 through 23 then change the focus and prohibit forms of sexual immorality that result in death or are contrary to God's created order. I know what I just said there is like, whoa, how did we get there that fast? Like result in death. You're like, you think of all these contexts, you're like, what? So what we have to do is we have to understand, as far as this death concept goes, we have to realize that in the ancient understanding, to put it simply, a man deposited a baby into a woman was kind of how the thinking went. So according to that understanding, to have relations with a woman during her menstrual uncleanness or to have relations homosexually or to have relations with an animal represented and resulted in a death because a child was deposited into an environment that could not sustain life. So it was essentially a murder of the child, which is also why, by the way, you see this whole random thing about like the don't offer your children to Moloch. It's like, what? I thought we were talking about sexual immorality. What happened? It's like, it fits perfectly in that way of thinking. Because again, relations within these contexts resulted in a death because they're being done in a context that life cannot be supported. And therefore, the same exact logic applies to offering your children to Moloch. Because essentially what you're saying by doing those acts is, yeah, I know, like that's how we understand this happens, but I don't care. That child can die for all I care because I want to do this. And that's essentially, and that's exactly the same logic with Moloch, because you're obviously worshiping another god, but the life of the child is considered inconsequential. So honestly, this next section, this 19 to 23, so the first one was pro-family, this second section is pro-life, which I think is really cool. Now, again, we may not agree with the science, but we'll talk about later how there are still connection points that we can agree with, and even just the principle behind that. Okay, so say like the ancient scientific understanding, like we know now, is wrong, but how they used that principle to then be pro-life based on their current understanding is really cool and is still a principle that we ought to follow. There's another aspect of what's going on in these few verses here. The second characteristic of this group is being contrary to God's created order, which means that created boundaries are being blurred or broken. God created intimacy for a man and a wife to enjoy. To lie with another's wife, adultery, which is one of the ones on this list, breaks two families apart. And a child of such a union in that culture was usually ostracized. So to commit sexual adultery, this kind of bleeds back into the pro-family thing, you're not only breaking two families apart, but why it's lumped also in this second category is that you are showing a disdain for life. Because honestly, to break family units apart, sometimes depending on the context of what's happening here, the husband of the wife that you committed adultery with could disown that wife. And in that culture, that was essentially a death sentence to that woman because they really couldn't support themselves in that culture. So not only does it show a disdain for potentially the life of the woman that you just committed this act with, but it also shows a disdain for the potential life of the child that this act creates, because they knew, culturally speaking, that that child was going to have a very difficult life of being ostracized and potentially even kicked out of the community. So again, it shows a disdain for life. And also a disdain of created order, because God has created one context for this act. And then homosexuality blurs the two genders and goes against God's created order for marriage. Bestiality is blurring or confusing of the created order between humans and animals. The word translated perversion, by the way, at the end there, where it says, any woman gives herself to an animal to be with it, it is a perversion. The word perversion could even more literally be translated as confusion. It is a confusion of created order. People and animals, you're not supposed to blur or cross that line. So again, we may not agree with the scientific understanding of what was going on, but we can certainly appreciate the many other aspects of why these unions are prohibited, and even the principle behind the ancient scientific understanding. These acts demonstrate a desire to abuse a good gift from God by using it in a context that he has prohibited. And these aren't arbitrary rules given because God is a killjoy. God prohibits these unions because they break families apart. They cause rivalries. They are power grabs. They destroy family units. And they show a disdain for human life. They demonstrate more concern for one's own pleasure than the welfare or even life of another. Again, in the ancient understanding, they knew that a child born of such a union in the adultery context would be ostracized. And in their scientific understanding, they knew that a child being deposited into a environment that could not sustain life was to kill the child, which is, again, why the child sacrifice is lumped in there too. So again, they demonstrate more concern for one's own pleasure or welfare than the status or goodness or life of another person. And they also blur or break down God's created order that was made for our good. As much as the ideology of our day won't admit it, modern science is continually proving that the created order of a man and a woman union in the context of a committed marriage is what is best for us physically, mentally, emotionally, and culturally. The problem with sexual immorality is that it is often an inherently selfish act, which is directly opposed to the biblical teaching of what love, which is what this union is supposed to be the ultimate example of, this understanding of and this misuse of it is directly opposed to the biblical teaching of love as an inherently selfless action. John 15:3 says, "There is no greater love than this, that a person would lay down his life for the sake of his friends." It is little wonder, then, why the next chapter focuses on how love, honor, and on how to love, honor, and respect others. We're just getting out of this section here. We go to idolatry, which is a misuse of worship, essentially, and then immorality, which is a misuse of the good gift of God, and how in even these groupings, we see that sexual morality, immorality by and large, is an inherently selfish action that destroys the life of others. So then that leads naturally into the next chapter, which talks about selfless love for other people that builds up and shows honor and respect and unity. The very first specific command we will see in the next chapter flips the background of our chapter today around. Ham dishonored his father and mother by taking advantage of his mother in an attempted power grab. The first specific command we read in chapter 9 is, "Every one of you shall revere his father and mother." Stepping back a little bit and thinking of ourselves today, it is easy to read Leviticus 18 and think, I haven't committed incest or any of these other like crazy categories of sin. But remember what Jesus said about our hearts. To lust after a woman is to commit adultery with her. And also realize that even supposedly harmless acts, especially in our society's viewpoint, even supposedly harmless acts, like watching pornography, slowly work to rewire your brain, to distort how you view others, how you treat others, and even how you view yourself. And even this seemingly, supposedly harmless act has torn and broken countless families. God gave us a good gift to be used one way. And he designed it that way for our good and for the good of others. Jesus summarized the law in two commandments. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. And you shall love your neighbor as yourself. In these two chapters, we have seen these two great commandments described in warnings against idolatry and immorality. Let's pray. Dear Lord, I thank you for this text today. It is admittedly an uncomfortable text, but it is one that we need. It is a reminder that you are the source of all good things. All good gifts come from you. But they come intended to be used as you created them. And it's easy to read your law and view you as a killjoy, as arbitrary rules placed upon us that really have no reason or need. But we see time and time again in the world around us, throughout history, and even the science itself today is agreeing that your way is best. And I pray that as we humbly accept and live with the good gifts that you have given us, that we would use them as you created them. And I thank you for verses such as we saw in 1 Corinthians 6 about how you know that we are not perfect, that many of us come from backgrounds that we have not been perfect in these areas. But you, because of the work that you did for us, of how you fulfilled this whole book, how you have made a way for cleansing and forgiveness, how you break the power of addiction, and you break the hold of guilt on us. I pray that as you work in each of our lives, that we humble ourselves before you to admit that your way is best, and that we plea for your forgiveness and your cleansing. I pray this in your name. Amen.